Good evening. Welcome to the Salary Report. Today is June 27th, 2013. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm very delighted you could join me this evening. This evening is my last evening in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I'm headed down to Los Angeles tomorrow and then over to Texas and then from there back to Tennessee. And it's been an unbelievably productive time in California, and I've really enjoyed it tremendously and hope to be back in California sometime in the fall. So on my way home, I'm going to be spending a day with Dr. Joseph Farrell. Another great discussion on the breakaway civilization is coming your way. We'll see what we cook up. If you haven't listened to the first one, it's under the real deal in the archive, and it's a goodie. So I'm really looking forward to finally meeting him in person on my way back. Couple of upcoming events. You can always find events in our events section on the website. I'm going to be at the Polyface Farm in September, early September, for the wonderful Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund fundraiser. I'll be attending as a benefactor. Then I'm speaking at the Doug Casey Summit in Tucson in October. We have the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference. It was in Holland last year. A lot of you were interested in it. They're having a follow-up conference at the University of Colorado in Boulder, Colorado. I'm going to be speaking between October 10th and 12th, and my topic is funding breakthrough energy, crowdfunding, and trends in the financial markets, and then a speech in San Francisco in October at the annual appraisal or the fall conference for the appraisers in the real estate area. And that topic is going to be primary trend in the global financial markets and the impact on San Francisco Bay Area real estate. Our theme tonight is the empire draws the capital home. Those of you who've read my financial coup d'etat story or many of the stories I've written, I've talked a lot about how the empire moved the investment out of the United States and the developed world during the 90s, reinvesting in the emerging markets and in space. Obviously, where our money goes, our military follows. So it's the globalization of another round of investment capitalism, all following the changes in the global trade rules with GATT. And so we've seen capital flow out. And now what we're seeing in the last year is as the money is poured into the BRIC nations, you see them flexing their political muscles. We've had currency wars, various countries in both the developed and emerging markets demanding that the U.S. ship their precious metals back, which are stored in the New York Fed or in the United States. The empire has decided to exercise a little reminder of who's boss. Another way to say it is what Mr. Global giveth, Mr. Global can taketh away. And the blood is being pulled into the center of the empire and the periphery is being squeezed. I don't see this as a change of fundamental direction. It's simply, you know, the pendulum swings back and forth in the rebalancing of the global economy. But the rebalancing is always going to occur in a way that the center of empire is made stronger by it, not weaker by it. And that's part of this little sort of whack back that's happening. It's not just the targeting of the tax havens. We've talked about that for the last couple of weeks on the Salary Report and my blog post, Make Way for the Killers and the Targeting and the Great Tax Haven Roundup. We'll explain more about that if you haven't plugged into that yet. But this is going to be the whole, you know, the world other than G7 is going to feel that. This pullback, and it's not just going to be the emerging markets that feel it, or the tax havens are certainly going to feel it. This is a process as it happens because the financial system is so centralized and so global. It's a process that right now you're looking at it roll across your balance sheet and income statement as we speak. So I want to start to connect the dots in tonight, and I'm going to be doing more of that in the wrap-up because I want you to see how what the empire is doing translates into sort of what you're feeling in different parts of your life and investment assets. So we've seen tremendous pressure on the U.S. to start sending gold back, whether to Germany, Venezuela, or other countries that have started to demand it. But we've also seen the unallocated bank pools under pressure and all sorts of other pressure about collateral shortages in the precious metal system, as well as other systems, but let's focus on precious metals now. The way to settle those accounts is, if you're a central bank or the big banks, is to basically shake down retail. Another way to say it, the way to settle all the fights among the G7 is to pull it away from everybody else. And yes, you can pass a law and say, we're going to confiscate all your gold, but that's much more expensive and difficult. It's much easier to short the price than drive the price down. I mean, it's even easier. I mean, it's so criminal in laws, it's hard to imagine. You know, your Goldman Sachs, you announce the price is going down, then, you know, but of course, after you've shorted the price, then with the help of all your clients and investors and the followers in the market, you drive the price down. You make a whole bunch of money, including the use of regulatory terror to do that. We'll talk about that in a bit. And then you cover your shorts. That generates profits, and that profit is what you need to fund the purchase of a gold, which you can now get at a much lower price. And then you just send the gold back to the guy who wants it. It's hard for some people to fathom that this goes on, but I think what we're very much watching is the insiders covering their shortages at the expense of the outsiders. Last week, we had Ben Bernanke, chairman of the Federal Reserve, suggest that they were going to stop printing QE at some point, which, of course, everyone knew, and all the folks who've been screaming at him for printing are now screaming that he's stopping. Somebody dubbed it the taper tantrum, as in taper off the purchases. If you look at what the empire is trying to do, they're trying to bring capital back. They have a lot of things going on here in the United States which are strong for their fundamentals. They can bring capital back. And so when you stop buying up, and as you know, I think a lot of the purchases have been pulling the fraud off the bank's balance sheets. And if you look at the stocks of the big New York Fed member banks, they're basically where they were before the bailouts. So he's brought their balance sheets and their stocks all the way back, and they're in a perfect position to weather the storm. In fact, it's going to be the parts of not the center of empire, but the periphery who gets squeezed as he does that. So he thinks he's got the center in good shape, and he can start to withdraw from the periphery. Now, let me just remind you of a couple definitions, and a good place to go if you're not familiar with these terms is Wikipedia. When G7 is a group of countries that coordinate particularly financial policy, don't underestimate the power of that coordination when they make decisions. So if G7 makes decisions to start to engage in regulatory terrorism towards precious metal holders and they roll it out, then it rolls across all those countries. Lickety split. It's like a hot knife through butter. And so don't underestimate the power of their ability to get together and change policy. So G7 is US, UK, France, Germany, Italy, Canada, and Japan. Russia is based, G8 is you add Russia. And then also the EU is not a full member, but has representation on G8. And then G20 includes another basket of countries that then bring you up to a major portion of the global economy. It's got Brazil, Indonesia, South Africa, India, China, Mexico, Turkey, South Korea, Argentina, Saudi Arabia, Australia, and the EU is a full member. So we saw the first decision on the tax havens being made by G7. Putin was not invited. It was not G8. Interestingly enough, when G8 finally met in London last week or two, Putin showed up at carrying his own water and food. I don't blame him at all. But now we see with Bernanke making the announcement that QE is going to taper, and we see tremendous drops in growth rate in China and Asia, announcing of slower growth in Brazil. Brazil taking off some of the policies that they had put on to stop hot money from coming into their bond market. Now they're looking for money to finance their bond market. We see announced the U.S. TOPS confidence survey on foreign investment replacing China. Numerous themes, that article is up on the blog. Numerous themes you've been hearing in the Salieri Report for several years about the steps that are being taken to dramatically decrease the cost of manufacturing here, whether it's new fabrication technology or robotics, and of course the steps to increase domestic energy self-sufficiency, both oil and gas and renewables, the so-called oil card I've talked about a lot. But you see those themes played out in this article, and the extent to which in many respects the United States remains very globally competitive despite the, you know, the continued difference in the cost of labor. Of course, labor has come down tremendously in real terms in the United States. Big squeeze. I can't say enough about the impact of the slowdown in China. Think of it as the sort of Walmart carry trade. China buys our treasury securities. Those treasury securities finance giving everybody checks, whether it's disability checks or social security checks. They go to Walmart. Walmart buys all the stuff from China. And then China needs commodities that come from Brazil. And so that's why there's a very intimate dance between those emerging markets and what's going on in the United States, including how we finance it. And anything that ramps down on that so-called carry trade is going to have a dramatic reverberation throughout the global economy. We see riots in Brazil and Turkey and around the world as the capital withdraws and the squeeze is in. Part of this dynamic, though, is technology. You're going to see more and more unemployment, more and more manufacturing done with robots and with, you know, using information technology and new technology to replace labor. And so we have this constant labor devaluation going on, and that's part of what's kept it possible for the central banks to print money to base currency without it turning into hyperinflation. We're offsetting monetary inflation with a variety of deflationary forces. A big one, of course, is labor. As I said, Putin is the, I think, is the stinker in all of this because Putin does not want to see the empire succeed. Putin does not want to be part of one world government. The Russians can be pretty ornery, and they, you know, for many decades have been the stinker for the United States and the Anglo-American alliance. The latest round, of course, is what's going on in Syria, and Putin supplying oil and gas to Europe is a very important part of the Russian economy, and the last thing he wants is big competition out of the Middle East from Syria. Money and markets, so that's the theme. The empire draws capital home, and this is a very big deal, and this is a big change. Think of it as the financial coup d'etat is over. Bernanke has the big banks back on their feet, not to say that we're not going to see some real squeezing and reconfiguring in the financial sector in the developed worlds. We are. We're going to talk a little bit about that later. But now we're ready to proceed to the next phase. I think Mr. Global has in mind that it's going to be a bull phase for the United States. So let's see what happens. So with that, let's turn to money and markets. And I want to start with housing because our interview this week, which we posted this afternoon, was with a wonderful young scholar, Dr. Zinnia Mukherjee from the American Institute of Economic Research. I wanted to have a back-to-basics conversation about housing because the housing market is up. We're getting a lot of questions about should I refinance my home, should I buy a home, particularly in the face of announcements that in April the prices were up in 20 big urban markets, up about 12% from on a year-to-year basis now. Let me just unpack those numbers a little. Those numbers include a very significant amount of institutional buyers. We've seen institutional buyers jumping in and buying up single-family homes for rental and doing the equivalent of what I call roll-ups. In fact, as interest rates have been rising as a result of what Ben has been doing, a series of major IPOs for some of those roll-ups have been shelved and raised the cost of capital for some of those aggregators, and that's going to have a shift in the market. So expect to see the institutional investors slow down a bit. And as that happens, even though I think individual investors are going to be more interested, interest rates are going to cool it off. And we are, of course, coming into summer. So don't be surprised if the May, June, and July numbers are maybe a little less exciting in the housing market. One of the reasons I wanted to do this interview is if you look at the culture in America, it's sort of the lore of the American culture that home ownership is a good thing to do. It's a good financial deal. People are encouraged to do it. Now, if you go back and you look at the price of a home in the United States, a lot of the increase in valuations have been driven by several things. One is the mortgage interest deduction. So we've had very generous deductions for mortgage interest on federal and state taxes. Then you have just a pouring of federal credit into the mortgage market. So we have FDIC credit, we have FHA, we have VA, we have Fannie, Freddie. And all of these things have fueled an enormous amount of low-cost capital and relatively easy terms. Then, of course, we've had currency debasement and inflation and a rise in the value of the homes, really coming from a fall in the value of the currency. And finally, we've seen a significant growth in the size of homes around the country. And when you go back and you look at the historical rise of prices in homes and you unpack and sort of delete all those factors, what you realize is, you know, a home purchase can be as much consumption, if not more consumption, than it is inflation. I always marvel when I'm in Switzerland because so many of the Swiss see the purchase of a home as consumption and not investment. Why would you ever waste your good investment capital on buying a big home? The Swiss are much more reluctant to do that. Anyway, so you've had all these factors that put the wind at your back, you know, or the wind in your sails when it comes to home ownership. And I think there's a significant question as to whether those benefits will be there to support the market and what could happen if there's withdrawn. We've seen different policy discussions in Washington about removing support for Fannie and Freddie, privatizing Fannie and Freddie, trouble financially at FHA. All of that is simply the fact that if you look at what it takes to balance the budget, withdrawing investment capital from the mortgage markets and shifting it into the corporate or business or equity markets is very attractive for a whole variety of sort of overall policy basis. And that puts, whether it's the federal credit or it's the mortgage interest deduction, that sort of puts, you know, these benefits at play. And if they get withdrawn from the market, it can make a significant difference into how house prices will grow. The second thing is we've seen tremendous divergence in the economy. So there are some parts of the country that are doing very, very well, others that are doing terribly. We tend to be people who move around when you have that kind of divergence and you get caught in the wrong place. Things can be very painful. Finally, there is deterioration in the integrity of a home. I put up a wonderful quote from Confucius about the integrity of a nation comes from the integrity of a home. The integrity of a home is really under attack. So property rights are very much under attack in America, whether it's, you know, the NSA invading our homes through our cell phones to listen into conversations or smart meters, which can access all sorts of information about what's going on in the house through the Wi-Fi systems. Agenda 21, which really, you know, sort of starts to negate our water and mineral rights. There's all sorts of other risks. If you get a mortgage, we see more and more servicing and mortgage fraud. I just put up a story about Bank of America by one of my favorite financial journalists, Jonathan Weil, over at Bloomberg, on the servicing, really criminal fraud at Bank of America. It's an enormous, just a hideous story. But there's also corruption in the general population when it comes to buying a house and making sure you know what's really going on, what the problems are, quality of appraisal, inspection, all these other things. And then, of course, you have property taxes and the fact that once you own a home, you're sort of on the list to dig the municipality out of problems if they should have it. So what we have is a situation, and the other thing I should mention is if you look at any estimate by various researchers and experts on how much time it takes you to care for and manage a home, and of course it's much more time the bigger the home is, what you start to realize with all these things, whether it's integrity, whether it's financial, whether it's risk issues, is that buying a home is a major commitment. It can involve you with all sorts of characters that you don't necessarily won't enjoy being connected to. It's a complex decision. It's essentially a riskier decision, and it's one that takes a greater investment of upfront time and thought than it certainly did when I started out and bought my first home. So this is something you should approach with care, and you should really research and know what you're doing, because it's the kind of investment where there are 1,000 variables and one of them are enough to kill you. And so it requires a thoroughness and a complexity, you know, that's very sobering. And so it was one of the reasons I wanted to just revisit housing. Do I want to own a home? What are the considerations? One of the best things about the interview is Dr. Murkaji basically said, look, you have to decide both resources and time, so your money or your time, how much do you want to spend on a house, and what are the other things you can do with the resources and time? And I think that's a very important and very good question to ask, particularly as the signs of strength in the housing market make it all the more enticing for us to jump in. Okay, one of the things that could soften real estate a little bit is we've seen with Ben's announcement, interest rates had been sneaking up. And of course, as you know, we've been talking in the Solari report about the fact that it's hard to imagine that interest rates could continue to come down anymore. But interest rates started to sneak up. And of course, after Ben's announcements, they really jumped. We saw REITs get hammered about 5 to 10%, bond funds trade off about, depending on the bond fund, 5 to 12% record outflows from bond funds. And I asked our producer, Justin, to put up one of the charts of the U.S. bond aggregate. And you can see the prices of bonds have been falling. I think it's an overreaction. If you look at the sort of interest rates and the way they've been trading in a channel, we're well within the channel, and it wouldn't surprise me to see things turn as they have in the last 1 to 2 days. So to me, it looks like we're in a channel. And I think sort of the Bill Gross's announcement that the long-term bull in the bond market is over is a little bit premature. I would note a very important development that we've been waiting for. Gary Gensler, chairman of the CFTC, continues to insist that he's coming out with a new swap regulations in the clearance system that was required by Dodd-Frank. Given that those swaps, the single biggest volume in swaps is interest rate derivatives, and interest rate derivatives have made a mighty contribution to keeping interest rates down. Not to mention swaps have been very important to sort of manipulating the price of precious metals. So what those new clearance systems will be and what effect they would have on the swap market could be significant. Gensler insists the banks are ready to implement them, but it will be very interesting to see what happens. That comes in July. It's one of those trim tabs that, you know, I always watch out for, because if it hiccups anything, we could get some pretty wild results, or we could just sail through. But it's, you know, kudos to Gensler for hanging tough. It's something we need. Precious metals, we've seen the continued divergence between the U.S. equities and the commodities markets. Just when you think it can't keep going or diverge anymore, it does. We've seen precious metals price continue to move downwards. I asked Justin to post up a chart of the miners, the miner ETF against the triple bear, and you can see anybody who bet big against gold and the miners did well. The price of gold just closing, holding above 1,200 today. That's put prices at this point below the marginal cost of production, and we're starting to see the mining companies throw in the towel. Canadian mining giant Barrick announced they were laying off 30% of the office staff. That's a pretty big deal. Numerous small companies have started announcing that they're shutting down or they're shutting down operations. I expect to see a whole bunch of mergers, and you know, I think you've got 500 to 1,000 companies on the Canadian exchanges or in the U.S. exchanges that just are not going to make it. We continue to see the regulatory apparatus used to terrorize gold and silver investors, both in the United States and Europe. I just keep lists every day of the things reported into me. One of the stories I tell, and this happened to me personally, one well-known broker demanded several weeks ago that anyone with 20% more of their account in precious metals was asked to leave and told to leave and leave quickly. FINRA, the financial regulator, was coming in, and more than 20% was a violation of the suitability rule in Dodd-Frank. Meantime, the head of the firm kept sending everybody emails saying, don't sell your precious metals. You know, it was one of those whoa giddy-ups. But the fear in their voice was noticeable, and so you have the regulators basically making it impossible for brokerage firms to basically satisfy clients who want to own precious metals. The biggest one, of course, was another margin rise on the COMEX. All you have to do is bring the margin price up, and you'll squeeze out the speculators and scare everyone. But the squeeze on China and India is could easily be as big a part of the story because the emerging markets are the biggest retail markets for precious metals, and they're getting clobbered. And slower growth rates in China and India are certainly going to contribute to lower demand and lower prices in precious metals, although we certainly get reports as the price come down of major buying by retail there. It's not just precious metals that's getting the hits. The empire doesn't want leakages. Precious metals is a leakage, just like Syria is a leakage and what Putin is up to is a leakage. There's another leakage we've talked about, and that's Bitcoin. More pressure from state and federal regulators. One of the things you're seeing on Bitcoin, just like you see on gun control or many of these other issues, when a big federal push can't get the work done, you know, you see them pull back and then it, you know, about 2 or 3 months later, it starts to pop out at the state level. Bill Moyers had a wonderful interview on some of the mechanisms they use to then get together with all the states and start to put this stuff out on the states. It was up a couple months ago. It's somewhere on the blog. But it's and we talked on the Salieri Report at that time about Hot Coffee, which is a great documentary that we did in Let's Go to the Movies on tort reform. And it's an example of sort of how you go state by state. And when you can't get something with a big bang in Washington, you go play trench warfare to get it. But we're going to start to see the state guys go after Bitcoin. And again, that's shutting off the leakage. After the insiders are repositioned with precious metals, I think the shutdown of the miners that's happening right now will make their positions all the more valuable. And but it could take a while, and don't be surprised if prices can go lower. The Franklin has always said that we could see 1,100 and still be in the primary trend. Others say lower, but it wouldn't surprise me to see us go down to 1,100. July 11th, we're going to be joined by James Turk and Franklin Sanders for the Precious Metals Market Report, and we're going to have a very interesting conversation. James, of course, watching the international markets. Franklin watching the U.S. markets and operating, you know, with coins at the retail level. We'll start to talk about what's the divergence of the paper markets and the physical markets and what's happening and what they see. I think the one thing to remember is I've been so surprised this week how few people understand what the bail-ins are and what's coming. If you remember what happened on Cyprus, we had resolutions of banks without bailouts, but in fact bail-ins. A bail-in is where the resolution is funded by writing down some or all of the uninsured depositors and writing down some or all of the creditors. So they can get 100% write-up or a partial write-off. In Cyprus, a little more scary, we saw even insured deposits frozen for some period of time. And so you literally, unless you had gold, you couldn't buy feed to feed your livestock. And of course, that's one of the reasons they want to shut off leakage like that. But leakage is a good thing to have. So when you think about your precious metals, I really encourage you to think, divide precious metals up between sort of two pots. One is how much do you need per person in the worst case, you know, if you're in a Cyprus kind of situation, and then your investment portfolio, and you need to approach them very, very differently. The core position is about being free. It's not just about making money. One of the things I want to talk with James and Franklin about is, you know, for many years I've been the proponent of slow burn, and I think the system has far more power to engineer prices with a managed process. And so this will give us an opportunity to revisit that, because we are certainly watching the exercise of those powers with extraordinary global reach, not just in the United States and England, but throughout the continent, and then G7 acting with power around the world. A couple other stories I want to mention tonight. The president's new proposal on climate change very much is a targeting of coal. There's an important subtext you need to understand. Solar and renewables are in the process of taking coal out because of the fundamental economics. It's just the way it is. A lot of it is attributable to the Chinese that have run the cost of solar panels way down in a way that's very putting a lot of, you know, Western solar companies under tremendous financial pressure or out of business. But whether good or bad for us, the Chinese have really pushed the cost of solar panels down, and we're now seeing solar panels reaching the point where solar can, in fact, compete with coal. Now, that's that's not a practical application. That's going to take another 1 to 3 years. But We're headed into a world where a wide selection and variety of renewables is going to get much more competitive as we're seeing development of the battery technology that's even going to, you know, turbocharge it. The big issue with solar wind, some of the renewable energies, is that they're not a consistent sort of faithful steady supply, and that's where you need the batteries. You get the battery technology economic and reliable, and then suddenly renewables get powerful in a way that they haven't been. And I think renewables are only going to grow over the, you know, from here on out. It's and this is fundamental economics, but the president seems to be taking advantage of it for political purposes. Of course, one pressure on him is to keep doing all of the things we're doing to improve domestic supply in oil and gas, including improving the Keystone pipeline to bring oil down from the tar sands. In the new proposal, he's saying he will only approve it if it's net indifferent in terms of the carbon and climate, and it's kind of a neat little trick, since various experts have already said it is only because the Canadians will be harvesting that oil, whether we pipe it in or not. Go take a look at the stock charts of the coal companies. It's, you know, you can always say one of the good things in your life is that you're not running a coal company right now, because that is a very ugly situation for them, and very ugly charts. Big story about the Supreme Court basically taking a punt on gay rights, moving it back to the lower court jurisdiction, which as a result is a practical matter, then holds in favor of gay marriage. Significant financial reverberations. Most people are just celebrating or bemoaning the case depending on their point of view, but I don't think anybody started to realize what the financial implications are going to be to a wide variety of pension funds and Social Security. So, don't be surprised if there is, sort of the Teutonic plates are shifting financially as a result of that. Please listen to this. It's very important. There was a report, and it's up on the blog last week, that Facebook had offered an organ donor registration and had gotten an unbelievably positive response. Please, whatever you do, do not register your organs on Facebook or any place else. Do not give Mr. Global a list of, you know, what parts of your body are available and might be attractive. Because if you think that it won't be, you know, that you won't be the subject of dirty tricks, or you don't live in that kind of environment, I just don't think that's fair to say. Let's say the chance is only 1%. Why should you take that risk? Please do not give anybody the particulars of your organs and why they're attractive for somebody else. We've posted several announcements on the blog. We do have 3D printers making organs for human transplant. That technology has quite a ways to go before it's ubiquitous, but I hope it does faster than Mr. Global starting to look at all of the healthcare databases for available organs. Our hero this week is Glenn Greenwald. He's somebody I've mentioned several times on the Solari Report. He's now a journalist. He was originally a constitutional and civil rights litigator. Very, very intelligent, very grounded. And he's been a columnist for the U.S. edition of The Guardian since last year. He's a very popular blogger. He's been a blogger for quite some time and was a columnist at The Salon and an occasional contributor to The Guardian before he joined full-time. He's the one who coined one of my favorite terms, the one-way mirror. That is, they can see everything we do. We can't even see who they are. And I think Mr. Global's power is entirely dependent on a one-way mirror. And that's why I think two-way transparency is so important to positive change. Glenn was chosen as our hero this week because of his handling on Meet the Press. David Gregory interviewed him on Meet the Press, and I have to tell you, it was one of the slimiest things I have ever seen in my life. The short excerpt is up on the blog. Gregory tried to intimidate Greenwald with the threat of criminal prosecution for being involved as a journalist on the Snowden story. It was, you know, every time I think the corporate media cannot possibly be more sleazy than I have seen them be, it was one of the sleaziest acts I've ever seen. Greenwald handled it like a champion. It was the headline should be sleaze meets quality, quality wins. He wasn't intimidated, and he handled it with the intelligence and the ability of a well-trained litigator. and basically sliced Gregory as he deserved to be. One of the reasons it sort of got to me as much as it did is I watched for many years on my litigation lawyer after lawyer terrorized by attorneys who were so corrupt and so criminal. And they would constantly wave this threat of, you know, we're going to prosecute you if you defend this person. I saw it happen many times. We had one attorney who was the general counsel of the HUD Inspector General, and she used to intimate these things. We caught her falsifying evidence. I'm going to be talking about it in a Solari report. We put the evidence up. In fact, it's up online. We handed the evidence of her effort to falsify evidence in a manner which is clearly against the law. We turned it into the courts, and she was rewarded by, after failing to frame me, she had to leave the HUD IG's office, or she left the HUD IG's office and went to work as the staff to the Ethics Committee at the D.C. Bar, which says everything there is to say about the D.C. Bar in Washington. But I've seen this trick used against lawyers and journalists. There's nothing sleazier, and it's been very effective in many cases. It certainly wasn't effective with Greenwald, and bravo for him. Take a look at it. It'll do your heart good. One of the things that's come out of this focus on the Snowden story and the NSA is it's starting to dawn on many Americans what's been going on for decades. I mean, certainly my experience in 1998 and onward with very, very invasive surveillance of me and the people helping me of the entire situation on our litigation, I got a real education. I call it my enemy of the state period. If you've ever watched the movie Enemy of the State, it will give you a sense of what the technology is like. Another movie we've recommended on Let's Go to the Movie is The Listening. Go back and check that up. Italian film. And of course, there's my article, The Data Beast. But a lot of these stories coming out at this time, it's finally dawning on many people the extraordinary access to information that these technologies at the NSA, the Echelon System, artificial intelligence is giving. One of the things I keep sort of harping on the Solari report, and I want to keep talking about it in the hopes that it can give you a good feeling, is the extent to which these extraordinary databases from the federal government and from NSA, financed all with taxpayers' money, are literally being sucked into machinery that are then used to trade on inside information. These are systems which are used to win at the game of economic warfare. Don't be surprised if they're used in very granular ways to exercise, you know, to push the price of precious metals down at this point in time. It's quite extraordinary how they work. A commentary from William Blum talking about how Echelon was used in several instances of economic warfare will be up on the blog by tomorrow. One of the things that's come out as we've had this conversation is reports of Rolling Stone reporter Michael Hastings' death. Numerous questions. It's inconceivable to me that his death was natural. I'm assuming he was assassinated. But what's interesting is it's becoming much more feasible and understandable for people to appreciate the extraordinary force and violence in the system and the extent to which the intelligence agencies, and many of them, are operating very aggressively throughout the United States. If you haven't, take a look at my article, The Data Beast. I think it will help. Ask Catherine. I get the question again, what's a bail-in? A bail-in is the opposite of a bailout. There was great concern about the bailouts during the 2008-2009 period, and an effort was made with Dodd-Frank to demand that the regulators come up with resolution processes without the taxpayer and the federal government basically insuring more than the uninsured deposits and putting in the money to make things go. And so at the end of last year, and it was posted on the blog, the central banks, the Bank of England and the Federal Reserve published a paper on how to do bail-ins. And what it means is the uninsured depositors and the creditors are going to pick up the tab. And regulators will have broad authority to come in and engineer those things without having to necessarily go through bankruptcy. So expect bail-ins to come. And I think one of the reasons you want to think very carefully about how you handle that period is I think the banks, one of the reasons the banks and the regulators and the central banks are doing what they're doing, including in the precious metals market, is they're trying to batten down the hatches and get ready for being able to do bail-ins. It's something they have to do. You have to shrink the financial sector. Our financial sector in the developed world is far bigger than we need it to be. So it's simply a matter of time of how you shrink it. And when you shrink it with market forces, you're going to have banks going under, and the regulators have to be in the process to do something. Okay, question from Los Angeles. The Los Angeles real estate market is a seller market right now, sitting in a unique situation where very low inventory is chased by a high number of buyers. We are a buyer's sigh. My question is it better to keep our 40% cash we should put down as a deposit in the bank for a time until a more favorable time to buy, or buy a single family home right now? Here's what I'm hoping. You're seeing institutional investors slow down or pull out, interest rates rising a little bit, and we're coming into summer. The San Francisco and Los Angeles real estate market have been hot, hot, hot. Let's see if those factors help to cool it down. So I would be happy to sit with the cash in the bank right now, as long as it's FDIC insured. But you want to watch the market closely to see if those three factors give you a little respite in the rise in prices. If it doesn't, it says that the real estate market could be very strong for some time. You're in a high-cost area. The part of the market that's really pushing up, of course, is the $500,000 plus homes, and they are very much being driven by the strength in the U.S. equity markets. My guess is that that strength in the U.S. equity markets is going to continue. So if the equity markets continue strong this year and we don't see the change in interest rates or the institutional pullout make a big difference, then you may want to seriously consider getting in the market this year. Okay, let's go to the movies. I wanted to just bring to your attention the Ken Burn documentary. Ken and Burn and Lynn Novak made a documentary about the architect Frank Lloyd Wright. Wright was, if you're not familiar with his work, was arguably one of the great architects of America. Very unique, difficult personality. And one of the things I love about Wright's work is that he did a great deal, with small affordable spaces, small homes. One of his styles was called the Prairie Style, and with real focus on alignment with the natural environment, use of the sun and the space. But very much focused on very functional, small, and more affordable spaces, but unbelievably beautiful. And it shows an example of many examples of what absolutely intelligent design can do to make a home absolutely beautiful, even though it's very modest. And it's not unlike much of the tiny home movement, which I find very inspiring. I think beauty is so important for our survival. The manner and nature of our space is critical to our field, our health, our mind. And I, for one, am one of those people who would much prefer a tiny home that was very, very beautiful and well-designed to something quite big. And I've lived in both. And I think great design is absolutely essential. So I encourage you to watch that documentary, because I think it will inspire you. There are several others, including ones that show you many more. This one is more focused on Wright's life. And there are many more that are focused, really take you through many more homes, and so you can sort of tour around the country and see them. Okay, so let me check and see if any questions have come in. Yes, my niece just bought a house and is scheduled to close tomorrow. However, it's a HUD property, and the titleist company is making excuses for delay. Why? Good question. I don't know. I do know the subscriber, so feel free to email me directly, and I'll send you an email. That would make me a little nervous. I would want to dig in and find out what the story is. Again, what we've seen with properties coming out of foreclosure, and if it's a HUD property, I'm assuming it's gone through the foreclosure process. We're seeing a failure to disclose the things that ethically and legally you should disclose to a buyer about the property. And so this one would make me a little bit nervous. The other thing you want to make sure and check on is we've seen changes by the FDIC saying that when they resell a property coming through their system, they're going to hold back the water and other mineral rights and you're buying the property, but you're not buying the rights to the water and the minerals on your property, and you need to be very clear about what the fee title is you're buying. So with any government sale, I would be exceptionally careful, and I will email you separately. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, coming up, second quarter wrap-up. This is a big one, July 4th. I'll be doing it on Independence Day, and we'll have the transcript up, we hope, within a week after. If you have any thoughts on what you want to cover, as you know, the wrap-ups are a time for me to really help you get a perspective, and I'll be talking a lot about this process of the Empire bringing the capital home and what it means to you and me and our balance sheets and income statements. So definitely email or post on the blog any topics you want to make sure I cover. The following week, I'll be back in Tennessee with Franklin Sanders. We'll be joined by James Turk of Gold Money, and we'll be talking about what in the world is going on in the precious metals market. And then July 18th, a great equity overview with Chuck Gibson, Why Dividends Matter. In the last two equity overviews, we talked about sort of the danger of a sideways trading market, and in that kind of market, dividends matter a lot. And we also talked about the changes in the bond market and how it's going to be hard to get the kind of yields we want in the bond market. And those two are very logical move into our topic this month, or this coming month, Why Dividends Matter. So until July 4th, when I will be joining you for the wrap-up, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.